consider Shirley a standard reference in the field, which is her book on remedies in international human rights law. But I happen to know her from some time a while ago. I think I first met you at the Institut International de Droit de l'Homme when I was a student. Again, we won't say how long ago. certainly, it's my pleasure to have Professor Shelton here as not only a leading scholar in the field of the international protection of human rights, but I would also say a passionate advocate a leading light, particularly on the other side of the Atlantic, who has persisted and hopefully now will reap some rewards for that persistence under the new administration. Professor Shelton, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Many of my comments will, I hope, actually give some legal content to Rhoda's presentation, because I think much of the litigation experience and political action experience on reparations in the United States fits very well within precisely the construct that she talked about. But a few remarks to preface this. For the last week, I've been thinking how prescient it was of the organizers to schedule this conference at this point, less than a week after the United States elected the son of a Kenyan goatherd and the great-granddaughter of a slave to be the first family in the United States. And I thought I'd read a couple of comments that were published after the election, the day after the election. Eugene Robinson is one of the leading commentators in U.S. print media. He writes a column for the Washington Post, and he is African American. And the day after the election, he wrote, "For African Americans, this is personal. I can't help but experience Obama's election as a gesture of recognition and acceptance. The labor of black people made this great nation possible. Black people planted and tended the tobacco, indigo, and cotton on which America's first great fortunes were built. Black people fought and died in every one of the nation's wars. Black people fought and died to secure our fundamental rights under the Constitution. We don't have to ask anything from anybody. Yet something changed on Tuesday when Americans entrusted a black man with the power and responsibility of the presidency." So that was his comment. And then there were interviews being done with people in the streets after the election. And there was a woman named Lucia Grissom who was with her two boys. And she said, "White America finally stepped up and crossed the bridge. For the first time in my life, I can really believe we are equal." Her son was able to quote verbatim from Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And he picked the words that he said. He remembered Martin Luther King saying that someday people would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character, to which his mother added, "We're here, we're here." But I think the best comment of this type I heard was on our evening satirical news show, The Daily Show. I don't know if it's broadcast here or not, but a couple of days after the election, Jon Stewart had on the African-American comedian on the show, who was speaking something about the election. And he ended his comments by saying, "And John, I just want you to know that now we're square." And Stewart looked at him and says, "You mean after 400 years, it's all taken care of now?" And the man said, "Well, you've just given us, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, a nuclear arsenal and the keys to Fort Knox. We're square." Now, what's interesting about all of those, and about I could have given hundreds more examples, is how much people characterized, particularly African Americans, characterized Obama's election as a form of reparations, as a form of reconciliation. And it's curious to sort of speculate as to why this is and how we got to this point. And how much race may have played a factor in the election on both sides. And so I'm going to jump from that to actually the conclusions of my paper, because I don't have enough time to go through all of it, and I think it's important to sort of give the highlights. First is that litigation, broad-based litigation for slave reparations, colonialism issues, rarely succeeds in getting reparations through the courts. We have very few successful cases. On the other hand, I think it's been an important, perhaps even essential step in getting the reparations through the political process, apologies. And we have now a large number of apologies, including in July of this year, the U.S. Congress passing a broad-based apology bill for slavery. The teams of lawyers who work with the historians, who work with the economists, and with witnesses and those who are continuing to suffer the consequences of past actions are really providing a vital function. First of all, marshaling evidence, and I can't emphasize enough how important good historical research is. One of the examples Professor Howard Hossman mentioned, the Herrero case. There was an action brought against some of the companies in the United States for the Herrero genocide. Now, among the people who worked on this case, Sidney Herring has done some extraordinary research into the events around the Herrero genocide. And he uncovered what is probably the first use of the term crimes against humanity. And it was the German chancellor who used that term in 1908 to refer to what had occurred in what's now Namibia. Now, the fact that the German government itself recognized that there was a crime against humanity, even though it may not have been in the technical sense we refer to today, nonetheless leads credence to the fact that even at that time, it was not just viewed as unjust, but illegal. Similarly, the so-called Comfort Women case that has also been filed in the United States against Japan for the treatment of women throughout the occupied territories in World War II has uncovered a great deal of evidence that Japan was party to forced labor conventions that made illegal what they were doing at the time. And in fact, they have won a complaint at the ILO based on that case. So the more that type of evidence can be marshaled, which usually occurs through litigation, the stronger the claim can be. Secondly, taking that evidence and thinking it through in terms of what legal constructs are valuable to present those claims can also help to strengthen the case for reparations. And we've seen actions that are based on unjust enrichment, putting it in a nice context, as well as tort. A great deal new legal thinking is going into the issue that was raised in a question, which is how do you deal with a retroactivity problem? And there certainly are a number of circumstances in domestic laws within the U.S., and I can't generalize beyond that, in which the laws are given a retroactive effect on the grounds that there was no legitimate expectation of reliance on unjust laws that existed at the time the acts were committed. And so recently, at the U.S. Supreme Court, we saw the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act given retroactive effect in the Altman case, which was a art restitution case from World War II, on the grounds that Austria could not have had a legitimate expectation of immunity from a lawsuit for the acts that were committed during that World War II period. So there are circumstances where you can build a case based on the historical evidence to show that there was no legitimate expectation. There was great debate over the morality, justice, and, in fact, legitimacy of the laws at the time the acts were committed. And if you go back in U.S. history, you see the debate over the legality of slavery almost from the moment slavery and the slave trade began in the U.S. Thomas Paine said during his lifetime that when slavery ended, there would be a great amount owed to the Africans who were being brought into the United States. Some of the disclosure laws that have been passed, it has been uncovered that in 1799, One of the major insurance companies had passed a resolution saying that they would not insure any slaveholder or any ship engaged in the slave trade. So it was clear from a very early period, and I think more needs to be done to uncover this kind of evidence to make the case that this is not an unjust retroactive application of the law to ask for reparations for what has been done. And the third aspect in which I think litigation has been extremely important is in the terms that Rhoda mentioned, and that is litigation can itself be the condensation point, because it can bring together all of this evidence, the legal construct, and draw public attention to the injuries and the persistent effect of these injuries in society. So we have seen now, certainly in the last 20 years or so, a rise in litigation that has resulted in some cases in victory. We just had a couple of weeks ago a settlement on a restitution claim from World War II involving not claims by Jewish families or others who suffered from the Holocaust, but it was a case that was brought by braceros, Mexican agricultural and industrial workers, who were brought into the United States to support the war effort. They were paid for their labor, but 10% of that amount was withheld as a kind of enforced savings account, and for 60 years was never paid. It's been sitting in bank accounts gathering interest. So a class action was brought on behalf of the braceros, and the case was settled, and now the amounts will be paid. A website has been set up so that claimants can make their claims. So we do see some of these cases that do succeed. And I agree completely with the construct that if you have a limited class of claimants, you have a limited class of defendants, you have a more recent rather than an older claim, that you're more likely to succeed. So in the types of cases that we've had litigation concerning slavery, takings of indigenous lands, lives, and culture, and other domestic injustices that really have increased since the Japanese Americans succeeded in getting reparations for their wrongful internment and loss of property during World War II. Now, that case was a prototype in the sense they did not get those reparations through the litigation. The litigation set the stage for a congressional settlement that involved ultimately a payment to each African American, each Japanese American, in a total amount of approximately $1.65 billion. Another stimulus that has helped to bring a variety of claims into the U.S. courts came with what you call the second wave of Holocaust litigation that occurred after the reunification of Germany. Thirdly, I think that the Alien Tort Act litigation or Alien Tort Statute litigation in the U.S. helped to stimulate domestic claims. The Alien Tort Statute, which was essentially dormant until the late 1980s, when it was used to hold accountable a Paraguayan torturer by the torture victims' families for torture in Paraguay, but it was litigated in New York, was followed by the Marcos litigation, where Ferdinand Marcos was held accountable for violations in the Philippines, and we have had now hundreds of these cases. Set up a contrast, because here you had all of these aliens coming into U.S. courts to get reparations for human rights violations occurring in their own country, and yet the domestic instances of human rights violations could not be brought under that statute. But it stimulated a lot of groups and individuals to try to get reparations for various claims. Now, I'm not going to speak at all about the Holocaust litigation in the U.S. because I know the other speaker is going to talk about lessons from the Holocaust litigation. Probably the largest numbers of abuses within the United States and the largest number of claims for historical injustices in the U.S. have involved Native Americans. There's about 400 treaties governing Native American relations with the United States, but they run into considerable problems of enforcement because under a doctrine the Supreme Court enunciated, most of the questions of treaty claims are political questions that cannot be litigated. Congress has retained for itself the right to decide who is a Native American, to recognize tribes or not recognize tribes, and the treaties are considered more domestic law than they are under international agreements. Where cases have succeeded are not with the restoration of Manhattan to the Native American tribes, but in some cases where you've got smaller amounts of property or where you've got clearer recent title, there have been very large compensation paid to Native Americans for the lands that were taken. Other successful cases have concerned the return of Native American remains. There was an executive order that went out in the 1800s to collect Native American skulls and bones for scientific study, and the Smithsonian ended up with an enormous collection of Native American remains, which are now returned under a statute that was passed following litigation. We still have problems with the misuse of Native American names and stereotypes. I'm ashamed to say our local Washington, D.C. U.S. football team is called the Redskins. And efforts to force changes in these names have not been terribly successful. We've had a lot of issues of sacred sites that have been addressed with litigation and restitution of cultural artifacts, which has resulted in some interesting litigation. I can't get into all the details of that. Now, turning to slave reparations, the first case that was brought seeking slave reparations was called Cato versus the United States, C-A-T-O, and this sought complaints, these were complaints filed against the United States government itself, seeking $100 million in damages for slavery and subsequent discrimination, seeking an acknowledgement and an apology. The case was dismissed even before process was served on a U.S. official on the grounds that the court could not identify any legally cognizable basis on which the claims could proceed against the United States. And the court went on to say, while the plaintiff may be justified in seeking redress for past and present injustices, it is not within the jurisdiction of the court to grant the requested relief. The legislature, rather than the judiciary, is the appropriate forum. Now, why was that? Well, the main reason, the primary reason they gave, is because the U.S. government had not waived its sovereign immunity and therefore could not be sued. other cases then started turning to suing corporations who had been involved in slavery in the slave trade. These were consolidated in the African American slave litigation, which had 18 defendants, 5 major financial institutions, 5 insurance companies, 4 railroads, 3 tobacco companies, and 1 textile firm. the claims included conspiracy, accounting, human rights violations, conversion, and unjust enrichment. That case was not successful either, which I'll come back to in a minute, but I would mention a companion case in California, which did succeed, and it was a very innovative case. It was based upon unfair practices in the Corporations Code of California, and it claimed that the companies that were sued were engaged in an unlawful, unfair, or fraudulent business act or practice, because the applicants said, had we known that these companies were involved in slavery and the slave trade, we would never have bought their products. And so by failing to disclose that they were involved in this, they have defrauded us. And that claim went forward. Now, the consolidated case, on the other hand, was dismissed for lack of standing. And the problems that were there was that it was difficult to trace ancestry. There were not good records kept during the slavery period. And many of the litigants who were not themselves victims of slavery because it ended 100 years ago, they were not able to identify themselves or to actually prove a causal link to specific losses. So the problems that we've seen in litigation include the linkage problem, causality, being able to link past harm to present claimants, measuring harm, on what basis can that be done? Should it look back to the value of the labor that was taken from the slaves? Identifying present claimants through issues of standing and identifying present wrongdoers today. Whenever a suit is brought against government, we run into the sovereign immunity question. So many of the those concerned with reparations have turned to the legislative process, unless they have a claim that is linked to more recent events. And there have been a couple of cases that have arisen that have involved specific acts of violence against claimants who are still alive. Rosewood, one case in point, in Florida, in which you had an African-American township essentially burned down, people were